Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now. The government may be partially shut down, but that does not apply to politicians who are considering a run for president. And Jeremy, you can gird yourself, you can brace yourself, whatever you want to do. The campaigning for 2020 has already started.
So we should get ready for a slew of presidential announcements starting in January. Joining us to talk about it, Kay Henderson, who covers politics for Radio Iowa. Hi, Kay.
Hello.
And Paul Steinhauser covers politics in New Hampshire. Hi to you, Paul.
Great to join you guys.
Okay, so when you look at the field or the potential field, it looks like it's going to be pretty big on the Democratic side. How unusual is that, Paul?
It compared to last cycle, very unusual. Remember, the specter of a Hillary Clinton candidacy, which eventually happened, kept the competition to a minimum. Really, it was in the end, it was just Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders. This time around, as Kay and I are experiencing, we're seeing a lot of traffic in both the early voting states. So it's going to keep people in Iowa and New Hampshire very, very busy.
Kay, what are you seeing there in Iowa? It's amazing that this is already getting started, that these candidates are already rolling through these early states.
Right. You have candidates who were here on the 20th for a holiday party to say hello to progressive Democrats in Iowa's capital city. And you had many Democrats who came through the state in advance of the 2018 election. Senators Harris and Booker really made an impression with Iowa Democrats, but they are not alone in people hoping to make an impression here.
And when you look back to what happened in previous cycles, in 2016, President Trump did not make his announcement that he was in the race until June of 2015. President Obama didn't make his announcement until February of 2007 for the 2008 election. Paul, what about Beto O'Rourke this time around? A lot of people are watching him. He's an outgoing congressman. He lost his election for Senate against Ted Cruz in Texas, but he is reminding many people of President Obama. What are you hearing about Beto O'Rourke?
There's a lot of enthusiasm for Beto O'Rourke here in New Hampshire among some of the activist class. In fact, some have invited him to come to New Hampshire and have started up Facebook pages, and they're on Twitter as well with their open invitations to Beto O'Rourke. He seems to be like the current rock star among some in the Democratic activist class. I think O'Rourke is smart enough right now not to come to either Iowa or New Hampshire or South Carolina, because if he did, it would spark a lot of speculation. He needs to figure out what he wants to do. He came very close to beating Ted Cruz in November in Texas, closer than any Democrat has come statewide in quite some time. Yes, there's a lot of people who want him to run for president, but there are plenty of others who would like to see him take on Senator John Cornyn in 2020 in Texas. Hmm.
So he's a young guy, but he's also a white guy. Kay, is that a liability this time around?
That's something to be determined. The Des Moines Register issued an Iowa poll recently, and Beto's name was near the top, as was Biden's and Bernie's. And what occurred to me was, I think Democratic activists really are living online. He was very active with an online presence. And so at this point, I think everything that we see in terms of polling data is all about name recognition. Pretty soon it's going to be boots on the ground. People will be meeting these candidates face to face and making a different kind of evaluation.
What about Joe Biden, Paul? Is he likely to, if as Kay says, it's all about name recognition right now, obviously he has very high name recognition. Is he likely to stay where he is in these early polls, which is at the top of the pack on the Democratic side, after people start to get to know the other candidates?
Yeah, Biden doesn't suffer from name recognition, right? He's the most well-known Democrat, and if you look at any poll, he's got the most the best favorable numbers. But you look at past cycles, and the person who was on top of the polls when the cycle began wasn't always the person who finished up winning the nomination. That's just the way it is.
Jeb Bush was ahead in the early days of the
President
2016
Jeb? Election. President Jeb? Oh, no, he didn't win, did he? Right.
That's a good point. Now, Kay, I wonder if you could weigh in on this. I've been wondering if a Midwesterner will need to emerge for Democrats to be successful in 2020, because they essentially ceded that territory to Donald Trump in 2016. And, you know, there are some coastal Democrats who are running in the front right now, but I'm not sure that that's going to translate to people in the middle of the country. What are you noticing there in Iowa?
Well, one thing I have noticed is that neighboring Senator Amy Klobuchar from Minnesota spent a great deal of time, even though she was on the ballot this year, in Iowa prior to the election, campaigning with Iowa Democrats. And she brought a message, which you just referenced. Our party, Democratic Party, she said, needs to reflect Midwestern values. So we do have someone who's carrying that bucket, if you will, in addition to the other sort of lanes for maybe a moderate candidate and others who are going to emerge and sort of occupy different space within this race.
On the other hand, President Trump was obviously not from the Midwest. He's a New Yorker and had never won political office before. There are a couple people that are being talked about this time around who fall into that basket, including former New York City Mayor Michael Bloomberg, who seems to be flirting with a run, or someone like the San Francisco billionaire Tom Steyer, who's been running Trump impeachment ads for months now. What kind of waves are they making, Paul?
Well, Steyer's been up here a couple times this year. He's built up a strong organization in the state, Next Gen America, which is one of the top progressive groups that motivates younger people to vote. They've got offices here and in Iowa and some of the other early voting states. So he's already got a toehold in the ground here. And yeah, he's got a little bit of name recognition because of his need to impeach movement, which has taken him across the country. Bloomberg made a quick stop here just before the midterm elections in New Hampshire to endorse some candidates that were part of his gun safety coalition. He's obviously got plenty of money as well, you know, which will come in handy. It'll help you get your message out. Bloomberg may be, though, maybe a little bit too moderate for the Democrats. You know, all the energy right now in the Democratic Party seems to be with the progressives rather than with the moderates.
I think you can't count someone out who can write a check to finance his own campaign. Mr. Bloomberg was here a couple of weeks ago after the election and did what you would expect a traditional candidate to do. I mean, he stood outside in really frigid weather to look at a wind turbine and talk with students who are learning how to fix wind turbines. So he has done a lot to sort of lay a groundwork for a campaign if he chooses to do so. And he really is hammering on the climate change issue, as many of your listeners well know. And that's a popular issue with Democrats that we heard throughout previous campaigns. When you go to a town hall meeting, what do candidates get asked about on the Democratic side? Climate change.
And Bloomberg is also a big advocate for gun control. He's been talking about that as well. Kay, what about the women who are competing? Obviously, we're coming out of the Me Too movement, or we're still in the Me Too movement. And we haven't yet talked about Elizabeth Warren, the senator from Massachusetts, Kamala Harris from California, and maybe even Hillary Clinton. There's speculation she could run again.
I do think there is a slice of the Democratic Party here in Iowa that is keen to nominate a woman. But until those candidates get out here and have a conversation with Iowans and folks are able to see them on the debate stage, you know, the DNC has announced this series of debates that sort of will rival what Republicans did last time around.
Starting in June.
Right. Giving the candidates a chance to literally be compared side by side. I think that's going to be a huge driver in the conversation in 2019 and 2020, the same way it was in 2015 and 2016.
Okay.
For
and
Republicans.
Just very quickly, Paul, we've been talking about maybe up to 40 Democrats putting their hat in the rings for this, but only one Republican at this point, Donald Trump. Is anyone going to primary him?
Well, we've had multiple visits this year from Ohio Governor John Kasich. Remember, he came in second here in the New Hampshire primary in 2016 to Trump, and he has remained a very voracious critic of the president. And he is somebody who's seriously thinking about, you know, primary challenging the president. Keep your eyes on him. Let's see if Jeff Flake returns to New Hampshire again. There's even talk that maybe Ben Sasse. But regardless of if any of these guys do this, you know, Donald Trump will still remain being the overwhelming favorite to win, you know, the primary nomination battle.
Okay, just finally, I want to ask you, Kay, we are talking to both of you. You're from the traditional first states in the process, Iowa and New Hampshire. But California has now decided to leapfrog ahead of where it used to be to March 3rd, 2020, joining at least 8 other states on that Super Tuesday. How different do you think the primary calendar is going to be this year than it was in 2016, at least on the Democratic side?
It's really hard to think of this without remembering President Giuliani, who skipped Iowa and spent all of his time campaigning for Florida's primary, which was fairly close to Iowa and New Hampshire. That didn't work out well for him.
Kay makes a great point that, listen, Iowa and New Hampshire will still have their traditional role of winnowing the field. With California and Texas and a bunch of other states now going to be voting on Super Tuesday, the overall nomination battle may end a little earlier than we've seen in past cycles. But I think Iowa, New Hampshire, and the other two early voting states will still have their role in narrowing the field.
That is Paul Steinhauser, who covers politics in New Hampshire, and Kay Henderson, who covers politics for Radio Iowa in Iowa. We'll be talking to you a lot, I'm sure. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
Thanks, guys.
This past year, we've heard about a number of aging rock and roll musicians who've damaged their hearing after a long career on stage. Huey Lewis in the News canceled the band's 2018 tour dates after Lewis told fans he can't hear the music well enough to sing. Eric Clapton told the BBC that he's losing his hearing.
You know, the only thing I'm concerned with now is being in my 70s and being able to be proficient. I mean, I'm going deaf, I've got tinnitus. My hands just about work. It's amazing to myself that I'm still here.
And Roger Daltrey, the frontman of The Who, told concertgoers that he is very, very deaf and relies on hearing aids while performing. But as I found out in a story that first ran back in April, the problem is not confined to aging rockers. It's a problem for classical musicians, too. The viola you're hearing is in the hands of Betty Houck. She's playing a Bach cantata behind the vocals of the great Lorraine Hunt Lieberson. The recording was released in 2003, another high point in Betty's long career. She's performed at the White House for the Kennedys. She's played in a string quartet with Yo-Yo Ma. She's toured in the Middle East. But 7 years ago, at the age of 65, Betty just quit.
I completely turned my back on music. I didn't want to anything to do with music whatsoever. If I couldn't play up to the level that I was used to, I wasn't going to do it.
Because Betty couldn't hear. She can't say for sure if it's her career in music that led to her moderate to severe hearing loss, but it's easy to make the connection. Researchers say decades of exposure to the sounds of an orchestra like this one can take their toll. According to one German study, professional musicians were nearly 4 times more likely to experience noise-induced hearing loss. Another found that nearly 60% of classical musicians have damaged hearing. For Betty, the loss was gradual.
And I hid the fact that I had hearing loss. I didn't want people to know because I felt it would affect my professional career, life.
Because your colleagues sitting next to you would think she needs her ears.
Yes, they think, oh, well, if she can't hear, maybe we shouldn't hire her as a musician anymore. I just didn't want people to know. I was like Beethoven. He also didn't want people to know when he started to lose his hearing. So at a rehearsal, I would wear my hearing aids at rehearsal so I could hear what, there was a conductor, so I could hear what he was saying, what my stand partner was saying. But I'd take them off for the concert because the music sounded much better without the hearing aids. Then it reached the point where I thought, you know, I really need to wear them during the concert, too.
And why? Then, because then the music started to sound wrong? You couldn't follow the music?
Well, I started to not be able to hear things, that they weren't loud enough. And also, if I'd play very high, a couple of times I was playing very high, I couldn't hear it. So I didn't know if I was playing in tune or not. And then one day, I was playing a Bach cantata at Emmanuel Church in Boston, where I had played regularly. And I realized there was this passage which is called a recitative, and it's closer to the spoken voice. And the conductor kind of stops conducting there sometimes, so you just have to hear the singer and follow her. I realized I didn't have a clue where she was. It was total guesswork. I had to tell from when other people's bows were moving. And it was torture. It was torture. I knew that I was struggling, and I thought, okay, that's it. I'm out of here.
You quit just right then.
I quit on the spot. I didn't want to put anyone, any of my colleagues, in the very awkward position of telling me that it was time to stop playing.
Leading up to that moment, what was your anxiety like? You must have seen this coming.
I did. My anxiety was very great.
Your career was on the line.
Yes. I played three more concerts, and they were all Bach. I played the Bach B minor Mass. I played a Bach cantata at Emmanuel, and I played some Bach at the Marlborough Bach Festival. And that was the last thing I played. And actually, a father of a student of mine was at the concert. He came up after the concert, and he came over to me, and he said, I understand this is your last concert. And this is where I get choked up. I was there with the other viola players, and he said, let's just take a moment and think about that. And I lost it at that point.
For the next 3 years, Betty silenced herself. She didn't play the viola, and she did not admit to herself the gravity of what had just happened. Not only was her career over, but the music that had sustained that career was gone too.
I had decided that I was going to treat my hearing loss as a neutral event. And it's kind of take a Buddhist approach and think it's neither good nor bad, but it's just something that's happened to me.
In those 3 years when you weren't playing, how were you feeling?
I was very depressed, and I was in denial about what a huge loss it had been.
It was not a neutral event.
It was not a neutral event. It was a huge loss. But first you have to grieve. That was what hit me. This is what I have not done. And I started grieving for the hearing loss because it was a huge loss. And as a result of that, I discovered the sweetness on the other side.
Here we go. Asa.
Sierra.
Today, her life sounds very different.
Charlie.
Awa.
Whiskey.
Apa.
Papa.
Aga.
Every few weeks, she travels to a Boston suburb for therapy with an auditory trainer named Jeff Plant. He's holding a screen over his face so that Betty can't see his lips move. She has to rely on her ears and her hearing aids to respond to Jeff's prompts.
Papa Tango.
Teach Peach.
Tango Papa.
Pia Tia.
Papa Tango.
Ta Pa.
Tango Papa.
How would you rank that?
That was harder.
This is one of the things that I think for most people with normal hearing, they don't have any perception of the fact that listening can be extremely hard work for someone with their hearing loss. So you can do it, but it requires enormous amounts of effort and concentration. And so to do this task for 2 minutes is really asking someone to push very, very hard.
Was it almost like a physical experience?
Yes. And my brain really feels challenged by something like that.
If you didn't have your hearing aids in right now, how would you do?
I would probably do terribly. I probably wouldn't get any of it.
And Betty has finally picked up her instruments again.
Bach? Well, you said that's one of your specialties.
That's one of the things I brought, yes.
Oh, good.
I also have some fiddle tunes. Does that sound good?
Sounds good.
Okay.
She started playing small concerts at churches and senior centers for people who could use her help. Tonight, she's in a living room with a few friends. They're drinking wine and eating cheese. They are not musicians, but they can relate.
You know, what I miss most is the Messiah.
A few years ago, Bob Broecker fell off the third step of a ladder and hit his head. Nothing has sounded the same since.
At the holidays, I would sit and we have a 6-record set of the Messiah, and I would sit in the living room and everyone would go to bed and I would listen to the Messiah and just turn flip records after another.
When you listen to the Messiah now, can you hear it or you can't hear anything?
Hardly anything. You shouldn't say of the Messiah, but it's like a rumbling train because the sound, instead of coming in through your ears, comes up through the throat, comes up through the larynx and inside and your skull. So it's a totally different sound, and I don't know that anybody has ever tried to create that sound, or if they could.
And that's one reason why hearing loss can be so isolating, whether you're a musician or not. It's hard to explain to other people. It takes away the things that you once enjoyed. The others in the room agree that losing their hearing profoundly changed the way they experience music. At times, it is physically uncomfortable, and any song with more than one instrument is nearly impossible to make out. So when they sit in front of Betty in a quiet room, as she plays a single viola, there is a chance they can hear her.
So you know that tune.
Anyway.
Yes.
Don't ask me why, but when I can hear her, you know, and it doesn't happen in other occasions, and so I know it can be done, and she's got the secret. God bless her.
It makes me so happy. I may be playing out of tune. I may not be at my peak of playing. I don't strive for that. And I love it when people tell me that they haven't been able to listen to music and enjoy it. And when they hear me play, they can. And that just gives me such joy.
And that is the sweetness on the other side of loss. I spoke with Betty Houck in April.
This message comes from NPR's sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. With Indeed, post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free when you sign up at Indeed.com/NPR podcast. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply.
Mom? Dad? Hey, Google, what's on my calendar today?
You have one event called House to Yourself.
Oh, yeah. Hey, Google, add aftershave to my shopping list. Hey, Google, remind me to clean these sheets later.
Okay, I'll remind you.
That is Macaulay Culkin recreating classic Home Alone scenes using Google Assistant, a great ad to cap off the year. Here and Now media analyst John Carroll has been looking at the best and worst ads of 2018. He joins us. John, was it a good year for U.S. advertising?
Good year from a financial standpoint, certainly. The estimated ad spending in the U.S. is about $219 billion this year,
wow,
which is up about 6% from last year. From a creative standpoint, it's the usual mixed bag of the good, the bad, and the concepts with a capital K.
Okay, well, first tell us about the best ones.
One of the best advertisers of the past year has been Apple. Apple has three ads in Adweek's best list for 2018. They're really compelling, and they've done a terrific job. Another ad that has been a big success is the Alexa Loses Her Voice ad for Amazon. And what happens is they bring in these different celebrities like Hell's Kitchen chef Gordon Ramsay to substitute for the smart speaker's speaker.
Alexa, show me a recipe for a grilled cheese sandwich.
Pathetic. You're 32 years of age and you don't know how to make a grilled cheese sandwich. Its name is the recipe, you d-
So that ad won the USA Today Ad Meter Super Bowl ratings this past February.
I feel like there's just an endless amount of fun that can be had for advertisers when it comes to these smart speakers. There's also the Nike campaign celebrating 30 years of its Just Do It tagline. Those ads revolve around Colin Kaepernick, the quarterback who's been out of the NFL for the past two seasons after protesting against racial injustice by kneeling during the national anthem. Here it is.
Believe in something, even if it means sacrificing everything.
Yeah, this ad sort of qualifies as a best and worst at the same time. A lot of people thought it was really outrageous. There was a lot of burning of Nike products on social media. Other people thought it was terrific and really a bold statement by Nike.
Any ad solidly in the worst column?
Well, it was an election year, so was obviously a lot of political ads fall in there. I think the consensus was an ad, a video that Donald Trump sent out on social media that claimed Democrats had let a cop killer over the border from Mexico. A lot of people looked at this and said, this narrative is completely misleading. And a lot of people thought it was racist.
Well, in fact, it was pulled off the air before the election by a number of channels that were running it. Racially insensitive ads seem to be a worldwide trend this year. A photo from Macy's website received backlash because it shows a single black mother and three black children. That image sparked outrage because it's the only black family in Macy's holiday campaign advertisement without a father. What else are you seeing?
Dolce & Gabbana, the fashion designers, they had a video campaign that showed a Chinese model trying to eat Italian food with chopsticks. People thought it was mocking the Chinese. It was really insensitive. Back in March, Heineken launched a campaign for a light beer. It showed a bartender sliding a beer down the bar. It goes past three dark-skinned patrons, stops in front of a light-skinned patron, and the tagline comes on the screen, "Sometimes lighter is better."
You wonder who approves these.
I think it's people who don't go out of doors very much.
That is John Carroll, media analyst for Here and Now. And we've got a link to his Campaign Outsider blog at our website, hereandnow.org. John, thanks a lot. Happy holidays.
Same to you.
The last few days of the year are a good time to think about your money, and not just because of the stock market, which has been a bit scary the last couple months, or your credit card statement, which might be even more frightening after all that holiday spending. Experts say this is the perfect time of year to start making some smart money moves. For more, let's bring in Jill Schlesinger, business analyst at CBS News and host of Jill on Money. Her podcast is Better Off. Hi, Jill.
Hello.
Okay, so what should be top of mind for most people when it comes to taking stock of your financials at the end of the year?
Well, I think that most people are probably not particularly in the mood to look at their money situation with a week to go in the year. But I would suggest to you that this is the best time to do it. And, you know, there's a reflection about what was, but there's also an opportunity to look ahead and think about what your financial situation is going to look like in 2019 and how you might want to prepare for it. I think the challenge this year is that because of the new tax law, there are so many people who really don't exactly know what their situation is going to look like next year. And the big question for those people is simply going to be, will my 2018 and 2019 income kind of look the same as it did in 2017? And that may be your first jumping off point to try to say, what can I expect when tax season rolls around in April? And is there an opportunity for me to do something within this last few days of the year to take advantage or avoid some future pain?
Well, and I guess one of the big questions there for most people is going to be, can I still do a standardized deduction, which is now bigger than it was before, or do I need to itemize my deductions on my taxes? Because that was a big change in the tax bill.
Absolutely, because the tax code now says that a standard deduction is $12,000 for singles, $24,000 if you're married filing jointly, $18,000 if you're head of household. So what does that really mean? It means that if you are going to claim under the standard deduction, you're going to find it easy to file your tax returns because you don't have to go through and look at all those different items,
right,
whether it's mortgage interest or charitable. But – and here's this big but – if you are going to itemize, what it means is your itemized deductions have changed pretty dramatically, specifically in places where you have high state and local income taxes, because those taxes, state, local, sales, real estate, and personal property, those are limited to $10,000. And if you actually see that limitation and you see that maybe you actually now, because of that limitation, you're no longer going to itemize. Maybe you are going to fall into the standard deduction. That can really change your outlook for the year ahead. I'm not suggesting you have to do your entire tax return, but you can kind of eyeball this. I actually went through it with somebody who had no idea what her tax returns, like where things were. It took us a half an hour to figure it out.
What about your investments, whether it be a 401k or if you're invested in stocks yourself? Is now a time to sort of take a look and maybe sell some things or buy some things? Or what would you suggest?
I think that by and large, on an annual basis, to rebalance your portfolio is really advisable. Now, notice I'm saying rebalance. Mm-hmm. I am not saying you have to go figure out where the top of the market is, where the bottom of the market is, and be some sort of market timing genius, because we know that doesn't really work.
Well, and actually you said to me once, and I think this was very smart, that if you have brilliant timing and you sell at the right time, you then have to also buy back in at the right time in order to make it work. Otherwise, you may have lost a lot of money.
That's exactly right. You have to make two perfect decisions. Mm. And we know that over time, market timing really does not work. So what does it mean to rebalance? It could mean that sometime during the year, you work for a big company and maybe they awarded you company stock. And maybe you were fortunate enough to work in a company where the stock price went up this year. Maybe that position has taken on a bloated presence in your portfolio that you may have said, well, gee, I'd rather keep that to 2 or 3%. Now it's 10%. So rebalancing means that you're selling positions that have probably blown up, which is good news, but you're forcing yourself to sell them at a time when they're higher so that you can then reallocate and get that percentage back in line. Maybe you are 50% stocks and 50% bonds. If you're 50-50 still, that could be fine, but maybe things got out of whack and you want to put that allocation back in place so that whenever the next event occurs, and there will be a next event, upside or downside, that you're positioned in the way that is best for you, based on you, not based on anyone else, not even really based on your age, based on your risk tolerance and when you think you're going to actually need this money.
What about just savings, a savings account? How much should you have saved as you look at your finances at the year's end?
You know, it's so funny because when I talk to young people who are starting out in markets where housing is such a huge cost, this is a terrible number to come up with, right? Because they're saying, well, I'm spending 40% of my take-home pay on my rent, so mm-hmm. it's impossible to save. So here's the target. The target that we're really hoping for is that people are saving about 10%, maybe 15% in their retirement accounts, and then trying to make sure that they save enough to fund any emergency expenses in that savings, checking, or CD accounts. But you know what's been great about this year? We've had rate hikes by the Federal Reserve, and that may have cost you money in additional interest, but all of a sudden, savings, checking accounts, they're paying interest again. And I really encourage people to check that out because a lot of banks, the old brick and mortar banks, really pay piddling interest. If you go online, you are likely to find savings and checking and money market accounts at 2%, which sounds like nothing, but it sounds like a lot considering many of the big banks were paying about a tenth of a percent for years and years since the financial crisis.
What if you are near retirement? What would you suggest that people do at this point?
I think that if you are nearing retirement, the inclination is I'll just sell every single stock I own and go into safe stuff. I would not advise that. When I was a certified financial planner in practice, I think that many people would say I must go to cash at age 67. Well, you know what? Your retirement is probably going to last two decades, maybe more. You cannot usually afford to take no risk in that portfolio. I mean, if you're a gazillionaire, it's fine. But if you're like the rest of us working schlubs, then you've got to make sure that the money you invest can last you over those decades. And that usually means trying to beat inflation. To beat inflation, you need to have a portfolio that has growth, and some of that growth will come with stocks. I do think a really great idea is, especially if, let's say, you know you're going to be retiring within the next 5 years, it's a wonderful time to start crunching some numbers. If you want to do it yourself, there's lots of websites to do it. If you want to go talk to a financial planner, a financial advisor, make sure that that person does what you really need, which is crunching numbers, not selling you product.
What about credit cards? Jill, you and I have talked about this before. It is always a bad idea to hold debt on your credit cards and not pay off your bill every month. If that's something that you can do, don't run up a huge amount of credit card debt because you're paying a very high interest rate on it. But what do you suggest people do? Right now, we're being marketed to like crazy with all these, you know, cards are going to give you this much or that many miles and points and blah, blah, blah. What do you think people should do as they think about their credit card portfolio?
Well, I think that most people carry more credit cards than they need. And so what I really try to advocate is to pick one or two cards that you use. You can use some rewards just based on your behavior. So maybe cash back is better for you. Maybe travel rewards is better for you. Pick one or two and just keep those cards as your active cards. You don't have to run around shutting down every single account. But what you do need to do is, if you are carrying credit card debt, understand that the average credit card interest rate is something around 17% right now. Gosh, that's an awful lot of money to pay. Well, when you pay down credit card debt that's carrying a 17% interest rate, you are getting a 17% after-tax return on your money. That does not exist. And so before you start doing things like figuring out where the bottom of the Bitcoin market is, or even investing in your own company's stock, go ahead, look at those credit card bills, see how much debt is outstanding, go in descending order, highest interest to lowest interest, and start paying down that debt and earn that risk-free return, that double-digit risk-free return. Boy, that's kind of the best deal in town. Sorry you had the debt to begin with, but paying it down now, about the smartest thing you can do.
Jill Schlesinger, business analyst at CBS News and host of Jill on Money. Her podcast is Better Off. Jill, Happy New Year. Thank you.
Happy New Year, and thank you so much for everything you do for me. I really appreciate it.
The S&P Case-Shiller Home Price Index out today shows home prices are up nearly 5% from a year ago. But the housing market is slowing. Rising interest rates and construction costs are making homes more expensive. And in some cities, the use of prefabricated modular construction is starting to pick up in response to higher prices. John Erb is director of construction at Champion Commercial Structures in Williamsport, Pennsylvania. John, thanks for joining us. And you're building homes, apartments, and even hotels in a factory. How do you make a modular building?
So at our factories, and we have two of those in Pennsylvania right now, and a third one that we'll be opening up in Indiana in the spring of 2019, we manufacture, you know, three-dimensional volumetric modules that come then out to the project site and get erected on top of each other and on top of a foundation or a podium component to make up the entire building structure. So when you think of a hotel as an example, a typical module is going to be two hotel suites and the corridor in the middle. So it could be a, you know, 60 plus or a 70 some foot long module that contains, you know, two king size living or suites and that corridor component.
So it's not just the skin of the building, it's the components that go on the inside as well, even down to things like the plumbing.
Oh, absolutely. So ironically, the skin goes on the project site just like it would in any conventional building. The final roof gets put on site, but the modules come out so that the suites are virtually finished. So the tile and bath, all the plumbing fixtures and bathroom components are installed. The ceramic tile in the bathroom's installed. The carpeting or the flooring in the suite sleeping areas installed. The wallpaper is on the walls, and wow, the walls are, you know, painted. And so that, in theory, those modules are very, very complete when the boxes are erected at the job site.
Now, a lot of people hear the word prefabricated, and it's got some bad connotations, frankly. They might think it's cheap, that it's low quality. Is that a fair criticism?
It can be, yes. I mean, it is what the perception has been for years. But any person that all comes and walks one of our projects walks away with a whole different mindset.
Now, we're seeing a lot of projects crop up in cities, expensive cities, that have a real shortage of affordable housing. Is this a viable solution to what has become an increasingly large problem in major cities across the U.S.?
It certainly is. You know, the thing that needs to be thought about is the very tight metro markets can cause some logistics issues. You know, those 70-foot long modules may not be able to be that big. But from a speed perspective, it's absolutely a way to consider.
So how much faster is putting together one of these buildings compared to traditional construction?
In general, you know, in a suburban type of a setting, we'll say that we could save 40 to 45% of the construction time frame. In an urban setting, you might be looking at more like 25 to 30%.
Another big issue is labor costs, and that's one of the things that is making it hard for housing companies, construction companies, to build the housing that a lot of cities need.
Yep.
Is the labor equation different with prefabricated houses?
It certainly is, because all of the portion of the job that's built off-site in a manufacturing facility is generally built at a non-union labor rate. So when you're looking at, you know, high union markets, there's where some potential dollar savings can come into play.
So maybe a solution for tight housing markets, but is it good for the cities that they're in? You know, some people might see these and think they are literally cut from a factory mold. Cookie cutter comes to mind, and that, you know, all cities doing this will start to eventually look the same.
Well, the funny part is we would love as manufacturers to build cookie cutter. The unfortunate part is most of our projects we find become more custom every time. So that part goes away. The thing to think about, though, is the aesthetics of the building, the outside skin, maybe some jukes and jogs, if you will, in the overall design is what creates the character of the building. And that can make things look different. And generally, that skin part goes on the job site anyway. So then at least the appearance of the project is going to help with the city environment.
According to Forbes, about 3% of construction in the U.S. is modular. And in the next few years, there are predictions that that could go up to about 10% because of the reasons that we've been speaking about, this housing crunch and ways to find more efficient ways to build housing. We're also seeing Amazon and Airbnb show interest in modular housing. Where do you see this industry going?
It's kind of... We're not sure where it's going to go yet. The question's just going to come down to, you know, the capacity of the manufacturers that are out there and the risk level, if you will, that each of those manufacturers wants to get into with certain type projects.
Would you live in one of these buildings?
I do.
You do?
My home is a modular home.
Wow. And what's it like?
Like my neighbor's house, but yeah. A little bit bigger and a little bit sturdier.
Sturdier?
Sure. The one thing to think about in the process is when we manufacture modules to then be delivered down the road 300, 400, 500 miles from a manufacturing facility, inherently in the wood frame end of the business, there may be 25% more lumber that goes into that product. The modules have to be able to withstand that.
John Erb, Director of Construction at Champion Commercial Structures, based in Williamsport, Pennsylvania. John, thank you. Appreciate it.
Appreciate the opportunity.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Peter O'Dowd.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.